Go ahead, Brian.
My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Cody. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, that one is God, may you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thanks, Brian. It's now time for our speaker to share their experience, strength, and hope. Please help me welcome our speaker for this hour, Gloria.
I'm trying to unmute myself. My name's Gloria and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Philip for asking me to share at this speaker slam. Anyway, I want to welcome anyone who's new and tell you that you never have to feel the way you feel today if you don't want to. You know, you just don't pick up a drink. And it hasn't been necessary for me to pick up a drink since I got here. May the 2nd of 1982 is my sobriety date. I have a sponsor, she has a sponsor, and so on. And, you know, I've been doing the things that have changed my life for the last 38 years, and I keep doing them. You know, I don't say no. The speaker before me said, you know, he doesn't say no to AA, and I don't say no to Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I do, it's got to be a really good reason. My first sponsor said that if I ever said no to AA, that a leg better be broken, or my arm, or my face better be broken, in order for me to say no. And it hasn't been necessary for me to say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just celebrated my natal birthday in June, and I turned 74, but I feel like I'm 40, and I just can't stop thanking Alcoholics Anonymous for my life, you know, and I'll never be able to repay Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, where I come from, before I got here, you know, I was the kind of drunk that sat at the bar and batted my long eyelashes, and that's how I got my drinks a lot of times. And you know, I'm not proud to say that, but you know, that's my story. And a lot of times I would be drinking and my eyelashes would fall into my drink, and I'd look at them floating around in my drink, and I didn't care. I just drank them down, you know, because I'm a drinker, and I love whiskey. I like whiskey without ice, without soda, and you know, I like it straight up. I'm born and raised in Arizona on a reservation. I'm a Native American, and my given name on the reservation was Morning Glory Marie, and I hated that name growing up. I hated it with a passion, and I hated God, and I hated my mother, and I hated my family. You know, I was born into the wrong family, and I hear it often in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they thought that a lot of you felt you were born into the wrong family. Well, I know I was born into the wrong family. Because they didn't look like me, they didn't talk like me, and they didn't think the way I did. And I contemplated a lot of times, you know, when as a little girl, I contemplated, you know, beating my mother up with a bat, or, you know, contemplated doing things that normal little kids don't think about. I think I had an alcoholic mind, you know, as a little girl, because I'm a twin. My twin sister died when we were four, and my twin sister was very mean as far back as I can remember. She was mean. She used to take all my toys, and everybody in my family pushed me away, you know, and so I didn't feel a part of the family. I always felt like something was wrong. My mother, anytime I got close to my mother, she would push me and tell me to get away from her, you know, and so I didn't know what was happening. And when I was 5 years old, my mother had another baby, and it was another little sister, and I hated her. I hated her because my mother would carry her and kiss her. I would see her kissing her and loving on her, and I wanted that. I wanted to be loved so bad. I wanted to just be held in my mother's arms, you know, and my mother just wouldn't do it. She would sit on the couch, and I would go sit next to her, and she would push me, get away from me, you know. And so I didn't know growing up until I got to AA that I had resentments. I didn't know that I was confused. I didn't know that I had a lot of anger. But I knew that I didn't belong to my family. I just knew it. My siblings always pushed me aside, or they picked on me. And I remember wanting to stay with my grandma. My grandma was more my mom than my mom was. And I remember going to my grandma's house, and as a little girl, eating. She always had food on the table, had cookies, had tortillas, had all kinds of food for us to eat. And my cousins and I would go there, and we'd stay with her and spend the night. When I turned 13, I went to my grandma's, and she had some dolls that she had made for me out of corn, you know, the corn cob and the husk and the hair, and she had made little dolls for me. And I was sitting on the floor playing with these dolls, and I'm 13 years old, and a cousin of mine walks in, and he says, "Grandma, I need the key." And grandma threw him the key, and I didn't know what the key was for. Anyway, what happened is my cousin looked down at me, and he says, "Hey, didn't you just turn 13? And I said, "Yes." And he says, "You don't need to be in here anymore. You can come outside and play with us." And he was like 16 years old. And I said, "Okay." So I dropped the dolls and left those dolls there and went outside with him. And he walked towards the back of grandma's house. And then I remember feeling, oh, now, you know, finally I'm going to fit in somewhere, you know, finally I'm going to be a part of something. And I'm 13 and I've got all these things going on in my head. And my cousin opens up this locker in the back of grandma's house. And it had jars, you know, those kern jars, like for jelly. And I remember him opening that door and I'm seeing all these jars filled with water. I thought it was water. And my cousin said, take one. And I took one. But all my other cousins kept grabbing them, you know, taking two and three at a time. And my cousin took two and I looked at him and I thought, well, how come you get two and I only get one? And he closed the door to the cabinet and I was stuck with just one. And that was probably the beginning of my alcoholism, because I didn't want just one, I wanted more. And anyway, when we got to our destination, they had a big bonfire going on in the desert. And it's 110 in the desert. And with this bonfire, I mean, it was a huge one. They were running around yelling like wild little Indians. And then they stopped and they started popping those jars open. And my cousin popped the bottom of the jar and he opened it and you could hear that little psst sound. And I thought, well, what is that? And then I saw my cousin chug-a-lugging that stuff. So I thought it was easy. And I really thought it was water. I thought they were all drinking water because it was hot. So I tried to open my jar and I couldn't. My cousin helped me and finally opened it. And I chug-a-lugged it. And oh my God. It burned going down and it burned coming back up. It was coming out of my eyes and my ears. It felt like because it burned so bad, you know, I didn't know what it was. And you would have thought, Gloria, put that thing and throw it away. Don't drink it no more. But I didn't. I wanted to fit in so bad, you know, I wanted to be a part of so bad that I continued to drink it. And only this time I'm sipping it, you know, and then I don't remember. I don't remember what happened. And I came to in the living room, not the living room, but in the main room of my grandma's house, and where all the carpets were. And all my cousins were laying there on the floor again, right next to me. And my grandma woke me up and she says, did you pee on the floor? And I looked at my grandma and I said, no, grandma, he did. And that's what I am. I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief, you know. And so I lied. And my grandma told my other cousin to leave because he had peed on the floor. And I got to stay. And so did my other cousins. And anyway, what happened is I kind of remembered what had happened. And I remember drinking. And I remember... I thought we were having fun, but then I don't remember the rest, how I got home, what happened in between or anything. And anyway, when I went home, because my father moved us off the reservation and he bought us a house in downtown Phoenix. And when I got home, you know, I was hungover. I didn't know I was hungover. My mother kept saying, what's wrong with you? Said, I think I'm catching a cold. So she gave me medicine, and I think it was some kind of medicine, but I liked what it was doing. It kind of woke me up. So I went into the medicine cabinet and drank it down, you know, because it kind of like, you know, to kill, how do they say that? Anyway, it takes a hangover away. Anyway, it made me feel good. So I looked for some more, couldn't find any more, and I went on through my day and on through my week. And I could hardly wait to do it again. I could hardly wait. I thought about it day in and day out, you know, how it was going to be different. It was going to be different. I was going to stay awake. I wasn't going to go to sleep because I thought I had fallen asleep. And I didn't know I had passed out. And what happened is that July came around and we were going back to grandma's house, and I could hardly wait to get off that car to go to grandma's. And we got there to grandma's, and my cousins were all out in the backyard of grandma's, and And I know what they were doing. So I went back there, I ran back there, and my cousin says, "You want one?" And I said, "Yeah." So I went with both hands. I grabbed two this time. I didn't grab one. I learned my lesson. It's how you get it. It's not what they tell you, you know. You go in there and you grab what you want. And exactly what I did. And I drank those two jars, and I don't remember anything that happened to me, anything. I remember coming to, I'm in a room with no windows, and I got blood all over myself. And anyway, to make a long story short, I was told that I had stabbed my cousin, the 16-year-old, countless times, and I don't remember doing it. And I had to go to jail, you know, and I was tried as an adult because I was there on the reservation, and I went to prison. I went to a federal prison, a woman's federal prison there in Florence. And anyway, what happened is I was there for 4 years, and, you know, what are you doing in prison for 4 years? I'm a little girl, for Christ's sakes, you know. I didn't know any better. I was scared. I was, you know. Then I saw my aunt. My aunt was there. They called her the Apache Queen. And she was a big, big girl. And she had a flat top haircut. And you know, and she just was the boss there. And I had a couple of other cousins that were there. And they kind of like ran the place, one of the areas. And my cousin got me a job in the kitchen. And I got a job in the kitchen. I thought I was special. But they got me cleaning the pots. The pots were bigger than me. And I remember bending over the pot, standing on a stool to bend over to clean the bottom of the pot. And I couldn't reach it, you know. Anyway, one day I'm in the kitchen after cleaning up everything. And a cousin comes into the kitchen and she says, "I want you to get me a gallon of vanilla." And I looked at her and I said, "Vanilla? What do you want vanilla for?" And in my head, I thought, what's she going to do? Go bake cookies in her cell or what? You know, so I got her the gallon of vanilla, and I followed her to see what she was going to do with it. So I followed her and I saw her pour it into a glass, and I saw her drink it like it was Kool-Aid. I thought, oh, maybe that's supposed to be a good drink. So I went to the kitchen and poured myself a glass of vanilla, and it smelled good. It smelled like, of course, vanilla, and it was sweet. And I thought, this isn't going to hurt me because they put it in cookies and cakes and stuff. And sure enough, I gulped it because I'm a gulper. I'm not a sipper. And I gulped it down, and oh my God, it burned going down, and it burned coming back up. And it was to be the beginning of the end for me, you know, because I drank vanilla every day, every chance I got, I drank it, you know. And before you know it, it's coming out of my pores, and I'm smelling like a vanilla cookie. I'm smelling sweet and stuff. And you know, anytime I went past a corridor and there were women there, they would go, "Hey, baby, come here, baby. You smell like a cookie. Come here, let me take a bite." And they would do that, you know, and sometimes they got away and sometimes they didn't. And things happen in that jail, you know, in that prison, you know, that little girls don't ever want to experience. I never heard Alcoholics Anonymous in the dining room. I never heard any of that. But when I left there, I left with four things. I left with a certificate that said I was a cosmetologist. I left with a GED. I left with gate money. And I left with the disease of alcoholism and didn't even know it. When I left, I got on a bus. I remember getting on a bus. They put me on a bus, and I was a week shy of turning 18. We got into Phoenix, and they parked right in front of this big department store called Mako. Back then it was called Mako, So I went in there with my money, and I thought, oh, I'm going to buy me some clothes because I didn't have any clothes to be out. I was wearing some clothes that somebody had given me in prison. And anyway, I bought a red dress. I bought some stilettos, some stockings, and I didn't know what to buy really. But this lady was helping me. I told her I was going to do the town, you know, and anyway, I got all that stuff, and I got some hairspray, of course, Aquanet back then, and my hair was long, and I knew how to comb it up real nice, and you know, high. Back then, it was the big high hairdos, you know, the big beehives, and you know, I didn't have the type of family that was loving and caring, that were waiting for me to come home. There was nobody home, and you know, it made me, I didn't know it made me more resentful, but it made me hate. I knew what that was. It made me hate more, and I hated my mother, and I hated my siblings, and the only one that was home was my father. And what he said to me that night when I got home was, go to your room. You know, so I went to my room and got ready, made myself a big hairdo. And in prison, the women, before I left, they said, you know, when you go out, Ryan, you're going to go out to a bar, you know, be careful, because, you know, there's a lot of women that are jealous and they're going to want to fight with you. So what you do is you get, you know, the razor blades and you put them in your beehive. You stick them in your beehive. That way, if they grab your hair, because that's what they're going to go for, they'll cut themselves. And, well, you know, I put myself, my hair up in a beehive, and I stuck those razor blades in there. It was easy to put them in. And I went on my way. And we got to the bar, and we started dancing to the jukebox, and, you know, all that is happening. And to make a long story short, nobody ever beat me up, and I didn't beat nobody up, so they never got a chance to test my hairdo the three times that I wore it with razor blades. But the three times that I tried to take those razor blades off was a hassle, because I was drunk. I'd come home drunk, and I'd look in the mirror, and I'd try to find the razor blades, and I couldn't see them, so I'd go like this and try to get them out that way, and I was cutting my hands. And so I swore the third day that I was not going to do that no more. I wasn't going to put no more razor blades in there, because I lost a lot of my hair. And anyway, on a Friday night, I went to the same bar. And this time they had live music. They had a band there playing. And I'm wearing the same dress, the same shoes, and the same stockings. And I'm dancing with this guy. And I'm dancing. I'm thinking I'm the hottest one there, right? And I'm dancing, twirling around in this dress, and this guy from the band comes down to where I'm dancing and stands between me and the guy and says, God, you're pretty. And he was the first person that had ever told me I was pretty, you know, besides some of the women in jail and my grandma. And that light went on in my head, you know, the light that we all get. You ladies know what I'm talking about, you know, the bright idea. And I thought, this is my knight in shining armor. And sure enough, man, a week later, I married him, and we're going to treasure the road of happy destiny. I didn't know about the road of happy destiny yet, but I knew that I was going to live happily ever after, because he was going to take me away from my mother and my siblings. And it was the beginning of another end for me, you know, and he drank worse than I did. At least I thought so, but I could probably drink him under the table. I don't know. But he drank a lot. And I like that he drank a lot, because I love to drink. He used to take me on his, when he used to go play in the bands and stuff, he would take me with him, and, you know, I would be there, sitting there waiting for him to finish, and then the next band would go on and we would dance and stuff. And to make a long story short, I got pregnant. I got pregnant. Once I got pregnant, I stopped going with him. He didn't take me no more. He didn't want to show people how fat I was, you know, because I was getting really fat when I got pregnant. And my first babies were twins. And one died at birth, and I started having babies every year after that, you know, and I had four boys and you know, the insanity continued. I drank all the time. I drank during my pregnancies. I drank after my pregnancies. I just drank. I drank and I drank. And I got a job at a beauty shop in Scottsdale, and I was making money and I was making good tips. And you know, I would come home with all this money and I would buy my booze and hide it around the house. And he would come home I would buy him beer. He had his beer in the refrigerator, and he would come home very happy. And I am the kind of drunk that doesn't like anybody else to be happy. So I would instigate, you know, I would instigate a fight with him, and we would get into it. I mean, we would get into big old fights. I mean, he never came home and just said, "Today I'm going to be Gloria." No, he came home happy. You know, he was a happy drunk. I'm not a happy drunk. I'm a miserable drunk. And because I didn't know I was a miserable drunk because of everything I had inside of me that was ready to explode. And anyway, we would have these big fights where either I went to the hospital or one of my kids would, or something would happen. But the police were always there. You know, it's like he promised me the lights, the stars and the moon when we got married. And I saw a lot of stars a lot of times, you know. And I saw bright lights, and they were the police that came to the house all the time, you know, and I saw the moon quite a bit because, you know, I would call him names that Latinos don't like to be called, with names with their mother included, you know, and I'd call him all kinds of names. And when I was drunk, I had the filthiest mouth you could think of. And I would call him names, and he would grab a knife and he'd chase me in the moonlight. Around the neighborhood, you know, telling me that he's going to kill me. And I would run into people's houses and tell them to help me, and they would call the cops. And off he went to jail, you know. And I would, of course, I wouldn't press charges, you know, because, see, it was beat me, tell me you love me. And I believed it. Every time we got into a fight and he would beat me so bad, and then he would tell me he was sorry and it wasn't going to happen again, then it was over, you know. I would let him come back home. And I didn't know any better. I didn't know any better because when I used to go home and tell my mom, you know, this guy beats me and he beats the kid, you know, what can I do? And she would say, "You made your bed, now you got to sleep in it." So I was brainwashed into believing all that negative stuff. And one day my neighbor came and said, "You know, Gloria, do you think your husband has a drinking problem?" And I looked at her and I said, "Look at my face. What do you think?" And she says, "Well, there's a place for you, you know." And she convinced me to go to Al-Anon. And I'll be forever grateful, you know. I went to Al-Anon my first time, and I was, like, not impressed at all, you know. They talked about God. They talked about their significant others. And they talked about, you know, how happy they were now that they were in the program and stuff. And I just could not relate. So I went religiously twice a year for 2 years. And in December of 1975, you know, I mean, up until then, all the insanity continued, the beatings, the me beating him, and, you know, the kids and stuff. And I forgot to tell you that one day, he came home to beat me for the last time. And this was to be for the last time, you know. And I knew because of Al-Anon that I couldn't make my decision the first year. So I made it the second year, you know. So I decided I was going to divorce him. And I did. And I won the car, the kids, and the house. And you know, on December the 4th, we moved back into the house. And my boys and I, and we made plans for Christmas and one of my son's birthdays. And that night I put him to bed, kissed him goodnight, and hugged him and loved him. And I did what I did all the time. You know, I went to my cabinet and pulled out a fifth of whiskey and went to my bedroom and proceeded to drink it till I passed out. And I came to, like, way in the early morning, and to find, I couldn't see because I couldn't open my eyes, but I could hear fire engines. I could hear radios. I could hear people running and going ooh and ah and Orecita, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, I got to see, and I opened my eyes and turned to the right, and I saw my front door, and I saw the firemen carrying out little bundles, you know, and I knew immediately what had happened, and at least I assumed. And what happened is I lost my four boys in that fire. You know, they were 11, 10, 9, and 6. My ex-husband came during the night, and I guess he figured that I couldn't have the house and I couldn't have the kids, so he burned my house. And they found him, you know, like about 200 yards away from the house. He was passed out in a small little gully. And I became catatonic almost immediately, and I stayed catatonic for almost a year. And the first thought that came into my mind when I came to was, is this my punishment, God, for what I did when I was 13? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And I really hated God then, and I didn't want to live, you know, and I didn't want to live. But when I came to, there were people in my room, and there were people, like, looking at me, you know, and I didn't know who they were at first, but they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, you know, and I remember one of them standing up and looking at me, and she said, Gloria, you need to do something. And I mean, I couldn't really do anything. I was laid up in that hospital with tubes in and out of me. And she said, if you don't help yourself, we're not going to come back. You know, you need to help yourself. You know, she didn't say you're an alcoholic or you're a bad Al-Anon or nothing like that. She didn't mention that. And she said, you need to help yourself. And as they were walking out the door, I said, help me, you know, help me. And I turned around to see who said that. I didn't know it was me that had said, help me. And anyway, what happened is they sent me out here to California to start a new life, a brand spanking new life, you know. I was going to leave everything back there and not bring it with me. But see, wherever I go, I take me with me. And when I go anywhere and I'm with me, I'm the worst company I can be with when I'm drinking, you know. And they sent me to this house in Chatsworth, California. And I'm here to tell you that I didn't stay sober. I started more drinking. I found Hollywood. I found eyelashes that came out to, they walked in before I did. And I found mini skirts, and I thought I was the hit of Hollywood, you know. And my hair was long and it was black, and you know, I was really, really young. I was 29, I guess, when I got here. And what happened is that I started drinking in different places, bars, ghettos, whatever I could get, wherever I could drink, I would go, you know. And I started making friends or acquaintances, and they would take me to different places, and you know, and I finally got a car, and I started taking myself to different places, and I started hurting people, you know, and I came to the conclusion through an inventory that I started hurting the men that I was going out with or that I was taking hostage for the night, you know, and I would say things and do things to hurt them, you know, and because I wanted them to feel the same kind of pain that I felt. Because my ex-husband had burnt my house and I lost my children. So I wanted to hurt every Tom, Dick, and Harry that I could, you know, so they could feel that pain. So what I would do is I would, after I came to and they're laying there in bed, and you know, I don't know about you, but when I'm laying in bed, when I was drinking, I would sneak a peek at who I was with because I never knew who I was with. So I would sneak a peek, and if he was handsome, I would uncover him. But if he was not handsome, I would cover him back up, you know. And a couple of times I woke up with a blanket over my head, you know. And so it works both ways. And anyway, when I came to and they're laying there, I would take their wallets and their credit cards. And I would go spend up a whole lot of stuff. It seemed like every month I was changing furniture, giving it away and buying new furniture and buying clothes and shoes. I had shoes of every color, every make that you could think of. And and because of these guys and their credit cards. And back then, the credit cards, it was the one that they slide through, so it was easy to do. And I finally hit a bottom, you know, all that drinking and doing crazy things. Before I got sober, I got married again, and I thought he was a cuckoo bird from the VA hospital, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had taken me to a couple of meetings, and the first date he took me to the Hole in the Sky, and he asked me if I liked it, and I said, oh yeah, it was great. Now I was waiting for him to take me to a restaurant so I could order a drink, and he didn't. So I asked him to stop at a liquor store so I could buy something to drink. So I walked in the liquor store, and he walked in behind me. And he says, what are you buying? And I bought those country clubs or whatever. They were mixed drinks in a can. And that's what I bought. I bought two of them. And I had stuck one in my purse without the clerk seeing. Because I'm an alcoholic and I'm a thief. And I drank those two up so fast. He didn't know what hit him, you know, and took me to a movie. And then he took me to eat, and then he took me to his house. And it was a bachelor apartment, and he had a Murphy bed, I remember. And I thought, oh my God, I've never seen a bed that comes out of the wall, you know. And little Indians like me never get to see the real stuff that you see on TV. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have a lot of fun here. So a week later, I took him hostage and I moved into his place. And I had gotten a job at the VA hospital in Sepulveda, and I was making money, and I had bought a car, and, you know, and I was doing well financially, and I was doing okay, but I was still a drunk. And this guy didn't drink. What am I doing with him? You know? So I would tell him that I had to work late, and I'd go get drunk. And this time I couldn't come home smelling like booze because he was a sober member of AA. So I got in connection with a friend of mine, and she turned me on to some pills. They call them Reds, and it gives you kind of the same effect. And so I started doing those, and you know, that's part of my story. But my drug of choice is alcohol, and I got the same effect from these pills, and it didn't make me smell. And this guy would take me to meetings, and he would take me to fellowship parties and stuff, you know, and I would sit there like a good Al-Anon and be okay, you know, but I would be swaying because I was on those pills, and he would ask me, what's wrong with you? I said, oh, I don't feel good. I need to go home. And he would take me home, and he would buy me a six pack of beer because he knew I drank, and he would buy me a six pack of beer, and that beer would be replaced like maybe five times during the day. You know, but I would go buy some more and more. Because, see, I can't just drink one. I have to drink more than one. I need that effect. I need to be in oblivion. Because, see, if I'm not in oblivion when I'm drinking, I can hear my children screaming, Mommy, Mommy, help me. And that tore me up for a long time. And I could hear them. When I breathed a sober breath, I could hear them screaming, you know, and thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I thank God today for Alcoholics Anonymous.
10 more minutes for it.
Pardon me?
10 more minutes.
Okay. Anyway, then I took my last drink on May the 1st of 1982, and I didn't know it was going to be my last drink. And I remember going to a retreat and talking to a priest and leaving that retreat, and then all of a sudden, I call that priest and I tell him, hey, you know what? I'm an alcoholic. And he had suggested for me to go to a meeting of AA and raise my hand. And I said, but you don't understand, you know. And that's the things that I hear from newcomers, but you don't understand. But I do, you know. And he said, but I do understand. Just go and raise your hand and you'll be all right. And I did. And people turned around and looked at me. And after the meeting, they would come to me and they would say, it's about time, Gloria. It's about time you came, you know, that seat's been yours all along. And I said, you knew? Yeah. And how come you didn't tell me? And they said, we don't tell people they're alcoholics. You have to find it out for yourself. And I said, well, I'm an alcoholic, you know. And somebody gave me a big book. Somebody gave me a 12 and 12. I don't know where they I guess from the, they got it from the back room. But anyway, before I left there, I had directories. I had phone numbers. I had a big book, and I had a 12 and 12. And they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And, you know, back then, women were ruthless back then. They were mean, you know. They were, like, hungry for sponsees and stuff. And I remember I was, like, 30 days or 90 days sober, and they asked me to share, and I got up there, and I cried for 15 minutes, and I walked off the podium. You guys applauded me and thought you guys were crazy. And I cried because I missed my children, you know. I cried because I felt sorry for myself, and I cried because I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't talk. And as I, what I really liked was going to the meeting after the meeting, you know. After the meetings, we go to a restaurant and have coffee and hear the old timers and get sober by osmosis, right? And what happened is that this lady reached out and grabbed me by the back of my sweatshirt as I'm running out the back door. And she says, I want to talk to you. I'm telling you, they were ruthless back there. She pointed her finger in my chest and she says, you need all the help you can get, and I'm going to sponsor you. And, you know, I'm here to tell you that she was the best thing that ever happened to me. She walked me through these steps. She allowed me to rant and rave and say, I hate, I hate, I hate. And she allowed me to just be me, you know. But she walked me and took me through those steps and showed me how to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My big book is all tore up, you know, and I love my big book. And I have markings in there that she put in there and that I put in there, you know. And I'm here to tell you that, you know, my life didn't turn really great. My husband at the time, my second husband, divorced me. Well, I divorced him, and it was the best thing that could have happened to me, you know. I was 2 years sober when I met my third husband. I was going to meetings in East LA, and I met him, and he was sober more time than me. He's still sober more time than me and doesn't let me forget it. You know, hey, newcomer, get me a cup of coffee, you know. But I live a life beyond my wildest dreams, and I've had good sponsors, and they've had good sponsors. And, you know, I've always gotten a sponsor who is in a relationship, a long-term relationship. And, you know, because I want what they have. I want to be able to have a long-term relationship. And I've been married to my husband, who, his name is Alex. He's got 43 years of sobriety, and he doesn't let me forget it, like I said. And I've been with him 36 years, and we've been married 31 years out of those 36, and it's the longest relationship I've ever had. And I want to tell you that the most important thing that I've gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous is not just my sobriety and the God that I found here, you know, it's forgiveness. Forgiveness was a big thing for me, because I couldn't forgive. I finally forgave my mother for being the bad mother I thought she was, you know, and forgave my father for being a wuss, and I forgave everybody, you know, and I finally forgave my ex-husband who burnt my house, because you told me that I couldn't judge him because he was an alcoholic, and I have a spot in my heart for him, you know, because he was the father of our children, and I don't hate him like I hated him when I got here. I don't have hate in my heart today. I love. You guys have taught me how to love, and unconditional love is one of the most blessings that I've gotten here, is unconditional love from you and everybody else. You know, I'm here to tell you that if you don't take a drink, you're not going to get drunk. You know, if you take a drink in your mind, you're already drunk. That's what they told me. And I know the steps have freed me. You know, I'm a different person. I've taken inventory after inventory. I've worked the steps. I have women that are in my life that I sponsor. I have long-term sponsees. One I've sponsored for over 35 years, one for 30 some years, you know, and long-term sponsees. And they've become my friends, they've become my family, and I'll be forever blessed. I'll be forever grateful to AA, you know. I have what I thought I didn't wasn't going to have. And I was talking to my husband because I have a picture of my kids here in my office, and I have a picture of my kids in the living room, a giant one, and they're my four boys, and I thought I would never have grandkids. But my husband that I'm married to today, he has three children, and two of them have given us grandkids. So I have grandkids, and I have two great granddaughters, and I'm blessed. You know, I could have missed it. I could have missed it. There's nothing that I could do to repay AA. And thank you, Phil, for asking me to share. Thank you, guys. God bless you.
Thank you so much, Gloria. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And let's give it up for Cody.